Was there anything that you wish you knew before you took the LSAT?
It was so intense. If you stick with it and just understand that it's super gameable and it just takes a certain time to break through that ceiling, whatever that is for you, you'll succeed. And it's so much fun to watch yourself get smarter.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Before You Take the LSAT. I'm your host, Doreen Benyamin, and today we have a special guest, Yitzi Ingber. Yitzi, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Thanks so much for having me, Doreen. This is really cool. I've been following your brand for a while.
It's really exciting watching your journey and seeing where you are. But yes, let's hear a little bit about your background.
I went to law school, UCLA. My family always told me I'd make a great lawyer, and it was either that or become a doctor. So I went the lawyer path, and I got a full ride to UCLA Law. And that's because I studied really hard for the LSAT with one of the best instructors. Not you, but a really good instructor. And then I've worked in big law, I've worked in small firms, and now I'm starting my own law firm. But I also have a podcast with my name, the Yitzi Ingber Podcast, formerly the Jason Ingber Podcast.
Awesome. Okay, so let's start. Why don't we start before you started law school, right? Before you took the LSAT.
My parents wanted something better for me. They both had only graduated high school, and they had this high notion of what graduate school could do for a young man. So law school was something that my peers and some of my cousins had done, and I knew I could do it. I was like, oh, reading, arguing, writing, like, yeah, that's my jam. I was the kid that was, I was still friends with her at UCLA Law. The first day we went around a table just socially, like what different people, how they got into law school. And this girl that was from Iran, she was talking about how she used to go to a party at 15 years old, and if she wasn't wearing her hijab correctly, the party would get broken up by police, and she would get locked in jail and flogged for not wearing her hijab. So she's like, I want to fight for human rights. And then they're like, Yitzi, what's your reason for going to law school? And I'm like, my parents thought I'd be a good lawyer, and I used to argue for extra recess time. Like, I don't know how...
So that's a little bit about your background. And then can you tell us a little bit about how you approached the LSAT once you decide that you're going to study? Because obviously you had to, like you said, you had to do really well in order to get a full ride to UCLA. So did you have the intention that you wanted to get a good score so you can get a scholarship? Did you know that you wanted to go to UCLA? Can you tell us a little bit about that part of your path?
I wanted to go to Harvard. I settled for UCLA when they gave me a free ride to go there. And I was so law school minded from high school days. It was like my ticket to success. And when I was in college in Connecticut, I was in like a yeshiva program that had classes at night. In the morning, I worked at what's their equivalent of like Ralph's. It's called like ShopRite. And there's bagels that they sell in the morning. So I would go there at like 4 o'clock in the morning and make the bagels because I was trying to earn money to go to this top tier LSAT class, which is super expensive and really an elite group of students. So I would make bagels every morning for months. I almost got the ShopRite shut down because I didn't clean my corner properly, because like who's going to clean their corner at 5 o'clock in the morning? So I would like sweep the crumbs under the oven, and like they almost got shut down for health violations. So I cleaned my corner after that. But then I had earned enough money. I did the law school course, and I took the LSAT twice, eventually scoring a 169, and that was enough with my GPA to get a full ride to UCLA.
So you probably had a really good GPA also, I'm assuming.
I had a 387, and I had done some AP classes that bumped it up even more.
Wow. And did you apply to Harvard in the end or no?
Totally. I applied to 30 schools. Wow. Especially with the fee waiver, because I don't know, remember where I got the information from, but I knew that it would be important to negotiate my scholarship. Yes. So I applied to schools I had zero interest in going to, just to be able to leverage them against each other. And I recommend everyone do that, because it turned into actual money for me. So
were you able to, did UCLA offer the scholarship, or they offered partial and you were able to negotiate?
I had initially only just got accepted, and then I sent them a list of different schools. Like Northwestern was probably the best, because it's like a slightly higher ranked school, although they abolished rankings, or they're starting to snub them. they were slightly higher ranked and they had offered me some scholarship money. And I wrote to Dean Schwartz, who was the Dean of Admissions at the time. I said, hey, like, I really prefer the weather in LA to Chicago, but I'm going to have to go to Chicago with this offer. And then that's when the offer came through. And I actually got off the waitlist in Georgetown, and then they offered me money off the waitlist, which I thought was, like, bizarre. They gave me $90,000. I was initially just on the waitlist because I sent them what UCLA had sent, and because I just wanted to see how far I could take things. Yeah.
Wait, can you share a little bit more about that? Because I think a lot of people are interested. If you have any other tips or stories, how to navigate the scholarship negotiation or how to think about applying, because I think some people know about this, but they don't necessarily know how to approach it. So because you did it, and it sounds like you did it yourself on your own, I'm curious if you could share a little bit more, if you have any other insights.
Yeah, I had known for sure that unless I was going to go to literally Harvard, maybe Columbia where you went, I was not going to pay full price to go to law school. I did a semester abroad while I was in law school, and the law school that I had went to in Vienna, where I worked at the best law firm in Vienna, like top tier society, and so I got a taste of what that is. The law school was $500 a year, and the books were like $100, which tells you how fraudulent and how monopolistic and terrible it's gotten over here, because it's the same function in society, so it shouldn't cost 100x more to go to law school. But I just knew. And there's also the guy that wrote Moneyball. Yeah. He had done a study for like a hedge fund or a big law firm, I forget, about what's the best indicator to determine for them to hire best associates. And the least indicator, I don't know if you know this already, but the least indicator of success was what law school people go to. That had no bearing on what earnings these people would provide. And I'm sure it's because there are some tales where there are people that go to lower tier law schools and they outperform because they have a chip on their shoulder, and medium of Harvard versus medium of like a 100th ranked school is probably obvious, but overall it's not an indicator. So I knew that my one thing was I didn't want to have debt. So it was super important to me to get that. And that was something that motivated me while I was studying. I was like, if I could just get, I scored a 165 the first time I took it. But there was no way that I was going to settle for that, because I knew that those four extra points that I could scrounge out would translate to so many dollars in scholarship funds. So once I had that 169 score, though, they give you fee waivers for most schools that find you an attractive candidate, and most schools will just give you the fee waiver because they're just trying to lure you in. So I just knew that I needed to do that, and I took a friend's advice, and a friend of mine who's married with four kids also, we flew to different law schools to interview, like Northwestern. There wasn't Zoom back then, I'm able to say that, and so I had to go in person for this interview, and we did that knowing there was no way. The cold was so biting, it was like March, and it was so terrible. I was like, how do people live here ever? But I knew that if I got the acceptance alone, then I can go to Fordham for free. So it was worth the $300 flight and the day and a half that it took to do that.
That's amazing. Okay, yeah. So I think being strategic about the whole application process can be really useful. And so hearing that part of your story, I'm sure some people can pick up a few things that they can apply to their own path. Was there anything that you wish you knew before you took the LSAT?
It was so intense. I think of myself as very smart, and I was extremely humbled by the experience. I was stuck in the 150s, and it's a gameable IQ test, so it was really humbling to be stuck in the 150s for months, to the point that my LSAT instructor, who, like I said, I'm friends with him to today, like, he has his best intentions for me. He looked at me one point, he's like, I don't think, maybe this isn't for you, like, maybe you're not supposed to do this. And he was really just being genuine about it, and
yeah.
I would love to say, oh, that motivated me, and that got, but no, I was still stuck in the 150s for a while. So, but if you stick with it and just understand that it's super gameable and it just takes a certain time to break through that ceiling, whatever that is for you, you'll succeed. And it's so much fun to watch yourself get smarter. Like, my reading comprehension actually improved. It's very much dialed into what you need as a lawyer. It doesn't seem that way because they make you do like Sudoku on crack for the logic games. So I'm not actually sure how that plays into everything else, but 75% of the test is just reading comprehension. And that's all it is for being a lawyer. You got to read through these dense cases, and even law school was difficult. So it helps you a little bit, and it's very necessary.
So can we talk a little bit about your experience at UCLA Law, whether as like a 1L or what you were involved with as a 2L and 3L? What did you expect when you went into law school, and how did your experience actually match or not match your expectations?
It was so much better than I could have imagined, like the actuality of it. And I've been looking forward to this, like I said, since I was a teenager. This was something that I really wanted and fetishized, and it blew my expectations out of the water. It could be for me because I had lived in such a big bubble, and this was like kind of my first taste of living outside of that. That added to the novelty and amazingness for me, but I don't think so. Being in a group of just so many bright, ambitious, hungry, young, motivated people, and you're in the trenches with them, like, there's nothing like it. There's nothing like it. I have lifelong friends. I mean, it's only been 7 years, so I don't know, you know, anything could happen, but I'm still very good friends with a lot of these people. You have such a deep connection. The things that I learned in the hallways from these kids that I went to school with and from the professors, I'll always take with me. And I guess I'm very fortunate I went to UCLA because the professors were just absolutely incredible for the most part. And I got to do a bunch of internships while I was in law school. I did a semester abroad. I'm just really grateful. It was an amazing experience.
So can you share a little bit about your 1L experience? Like, how did you approach your first year? Did you talk to anybody beforehand? Did you talk to 2Ls? Was there anything that you found useful for yourself?
Yes. The thing that you can do to prepare is do the practice exams from day one. I have a friend that didn't go to class, and he graduated top of his class. Never went to class. UCLA, too. So I really took his advice seriously because it was at my school. We had some of the same professors. He stopped going to class once he understood that it was just about the exams, and he was still doing really, really well. Like I said, top of the class. And that was true. My favorite professor, in terms of how she brought the material alive, and I was so deeply engaged in every class, it was kind of a scam. I knew that it was only going to be about the exam, so I was having a good time in class, but at night I wasn't reading her side interesting readings. I was just trying to figure out how to game her exam. And her exam had nothing to do with these abstract, beautiful discussions about women's rights in connection with the criminal justice system, and had nothing to do with that. It was like very black letter law. So I feel bad for different folks that were in that class, but definitely just go with the exams. And there's such an emphasis on grades, and it is really important, but only marginally, because I ended up in big law and I didn't have good grades. And you can do that too if you want. There's all different types of ways to get to big law if that's something that you really, really want. So grades don't matter quite as much, but there's definitely a way to get good grades if you want to do that as well.
Okay, so let's talk about that, because a lot of people are thinking about grades, whether they're in law school or sometimes I feel like even before they're thinking about it, they're thinking about their grades in law school. So how do you go from having not so good grades, as you're saying, for yourself, and then you get into big law, right? Because I feel like people generally recognize that big law is not easy and it's prestigious, and most people associate it with having really like top of the class grades. So I'm curious to hear about your experience.
The top tier law schools, law firms, they'll never hire someone without good grades. Like, I don't think that there's any exceptions, but what do I know? First of all, I have a story. This guy that I went to school with, and I did this a lot in undergrad, my undergrad course, but he told me he did this in law school, where he would get a B+, he would go to the professor and be like, I feel like I did A- work. And the professor would be like, okay. And he just bumped his grade up. Like, I was like, why didn't I think of that? You know, I had certain relationships with some professors that probably would have done that for me if I even knew that was on the table. Like, there was some formality that I thought was greater, but it's always just people. It always boils down to people.
It's negotiations,
and you negotiate with people. You don't negotiate with companies. You don't negotiate using the law. You negotiate with people. And this kid gained the system like that, and he's at Latham, so I won't say more. I mean, he was smart. I used to study with him. My first semester I did really, really well. My second semester not as well, and then I kind of had mixed grades after that, but really not a great GPA going out. And I ended up at Reed Smith and Squire Patton Boggs. The way that I got those jobs was, first, I was a staff attorney at Reed Smith, so you're not a full associate. I was doing the same work. I didn't care that I wasn't getting paid as much because I wanted to taste what Big Law is all about. I wanted to get that quality of work, that experience, that level of representation, like I was representing institutional clients. And then I leveraged the fact that I was in that environment to be a full associate at Squire Patton Boggs, and then realized I didn't necessarily want that lifestyle, but it was very rewarding nonetheless. And I had one time where I was at a cocktail party, a UCLA threw a cocktail party. They're always trying to get you jobs. Like the career admissions folks, that's their whole job, is to try and get you a job.
Right.
So they're throwing on these events, and I found them very helpful. And I just schmoozed with this guy. Like I was just talking to him over popcorn shrimp and like drinking some champagne or whatever they were serving. I don't remember. And he's like, why don't you come to my firm? Why don't you interview at my firm? And it was like this really highfalutin firm where it's LIHTC, low income real estate tax credits.
Okay.
Where they're trading on a bond market. Mm-hmm. If you put affordable housing units in complexes that you build, you meaning real estate developers, not necessarily you or you, we should do that for a living. There's a lot of money in real estate. But if you do that, then they give you tax credits. And then these developers are so cunning that they don't even necessarily use those tax credits. They sell them on a secondary market. So this law firm, all they do is document the transactions of that. Like you can imagine the sophisticated clients that they're dealing with. And I just because I was schmoozing with this guy, he offered me interviews at this firm. And there was a lot of opportunities like that. So it's all about people, and the more you network, the more you can get a job. And the more you have an abundance mentality, there are so many law firms out there. Like, they're all the same. Unless you know 10 people or a few people that you love and you really, really want to work with those people specifically, whatever you want to do, there's a bazillion law firms that do it. So don't get hung up on, oh, I need to get into this firm. There are a dozen firms that do just that. And if you can be in the room where you're interviewing at one firm, you can be in the room where you're interviewing at 10 of the other ones. And if you have that mentality going in, you'll be a more attractive candidate. And it's really the truth.
I love the concept of abundance mindset because I think that's very true, right? Even if you want to go to a big law firm, if you're thinking, depends on what you're thinking, but like there's 100 top law firms, right? So there's Vault 100. That's 100 different places that you can choose from there where you probably don't even want to apply to 100, but you can choose within there. I would say like the only difference is when you choose, because I've heard, you know, sometimes people choose based like purely on rankings, and there is a slight difference between firms in terms of how much people feel like they're supported or mentored or like it helps them get to the next level. I'm not sure if that's something you felt or experienced based on which firm you're at, but I think There's small cultural differences that are important to pay attention to. Would you agree with that? I'm curious. No?
I don't know. I've only worked at two big law firms, and they were both really awesome places to work. They were very competitive, but the people were very smart. It was a very young cohort of associates. They all, for the most part, worked together. A few of them were very cutthroat, but I felt very mentored. I had one partner at one of the firms that was... he would refer to himself in the third person. So that was difficult because the guy would literally call himself the czar of his subject area and would kind of ask you to refer to him as that. So that was a little bit challenging. But other than that experience, it was overall really enjoyable. And if you can get that experience, you should do it because it's just a different level. It's just a different level of lawyering.
I think also another thing about your path that I think to me at least stands out is like what you were just saying, the abundance mindset, but also I think there's a little bit of like a hustle, right? Like you're creating your own opportunities. You're not waiting for things to have like a clear, this is exact, right? Because like, let's say you do OCI, that's a clear path, right? It exists. You have these interviews lined up or whatever, but you were able to create these opportunities for yourself by, and you didn't even know you were necessarily, you didn't know where it would lead, right? But you're attending these events, you're putting yourself out there, and then you got an interview out of it. We can also talk about your podcast. I think some of what you're doing with your podcast, and you've mentioned it yourself before, it creates opportunities for you that you never know what's going to come out of it, right? And you can correct me if you think differently, I don't think you can really go into it expecting opportunities necessarily, right? Like you don't know what you're going to get out of it, it feels different when you go into it with a certain expectation, but But it does. It ultimately, like, you're having these conversations with people that you might not otherwise have conversations with. Now they're thinking about you and the platform, not only that you gave them, but maybe how you might be able to work together in the future. I think that's really important, is like, it's just the fact that you don't sit around waiting for it to be like a certain way. You go after it. Yes.
Yeah, totally. I would look up firms that had a need on LinkedIn. And if they posted a job, I know they have a need. And then I wouldn't apply through the regular channel. They say, oh, apply through the regular channel. I would never do that. I would call up the firm. And then I would just try and get the decision maker of the firm on the phone. And then I would go to coffee with that person. And then I'd be like, oh, you know, I just sort of soft sell myself. And if not, I'm just developing a connection with this powerful partner at a firm. And that got me the job at Squire Patton Boggs. That meant that actual template.
Can you like zoom in on that a little bit? Like, what did that process look like, right? Because let's say someone's listening to this and they're like, oh, I wish I could do that. And they might be thinking like, well, what did you say when you were on the phone to get the decision maker on the phone? What did you say once you were able to get to coffee? Like, right, you don't want to be too salesy. And you were saying about soft selling yourself. Like, what did all of that look like?
So a lot of trial and error.
Yes.
In the 30-second version, I don't have 75 feet in my mouth from making blunders of all kinds doing this. And that is natural with just cold calling, essentially. But going on Indeed and going on LinkedIn, like, for the most part, they find it at worst cute. Like, okay, this person's just, like, trying something here, you know?
Yeah.
And, like, who doesn't like that? Like, people find that so attractive. Like, we all love that. We love that person that's punching above their weight class. Like, we're rooting for that person.
Don't,
and you feel it. You feel it, like, for the most. And then there were certain companies or law firms that I did that template, and they were so rude. And, like, what are you doing? Like, and then I'm like, I don't want to work there anyways. Like, I just found out if I would just send my resume and then they would set up an interview. Everyone could perform well in an interview. Both they're interviewing you, you're interviewing them. They could present that this is like the best place to work and you're going to love it here. And like, you're not going to know unless you have inside information. So you're dodging bullets if you are just being yourself. And once I got the coffees, I would just feel out, like, because it's possible it's just an old job posting. I would just ask for advice. Everyone loves giving advice, and it's not conniving, because there were so many different times that I went to coffee and either I'm still in touch with them or they said one thing that I had now have in my toolkit that I understand, that I didn't know, that elevated my vantage point on society, on law, that I'm just like, that was completely worth it, especially while I'm in that young learning stage of my career. So doing that has led to actual jobs, and I think it's just a good experience in general, because that's how you get business as a lawyer. If you're going to be on the defense side, you need to be able to have that kind of mentality also. Like, you see that your co-defendant is sued, so you give them a call. Like, your co-defendant isn't yet represented, you give them a call, and you're kind of going to have to soft sell yourself to try and get their business. So it's just a good thing to practice, and people like it, and I would encourage everyone to do it. I literally got jobs that way.
What's an example of like a vantage point? If you remember, I don't know, but what's an example of like a tip or insight that you got that gave you a better vantage point?
It's more about hearing different career paths that I didn't know existed, different forms of litigation. This one partner I talked to had done representation of sugar when they were in litigation with corn syrup, and they were fighting this antitrust battle that he was manufacturing a media narrative on the side by saying how sugar isn't as healthy as corn syrup wants you to, or corn syrup isn't as healthy as they want you to think it is. And hearing that that's this guy's mentality of warfare when it comes to litigation, that you're going to put the media involvement as a top priority as well, was just very interesting. And that sort of came to mind. But also hearing from young associates, like, what they find. Because I would go to coffee with anyone. I didn't always get the partner. I would get the lower tier associates too. And like, how are they balancing everything? Some of them are young parents. Like, what's that like? How do you do work life balance? Is that a real thing? What are the expectations in general? And you know, it's sad sometimes hearing how people just fell into certain things that they aren't even passionate about. I'm like, ooh, I want to avoid that. So definitely worthwhile.
Do you feel like you were able to avoid that?
I ask myself that all the time. I wonder how much of the matrix I'm actually leaving. Like, I'm no longer an Orthodox observant Jewish person, so it's like, oh, I kind of left the matrix in that respect, but I've moved like maybe a half an inch away by becoming a Jewish lawyer. Like, how much, I'm a Jewish lawyer and I have a podcast, like how much of the matrix have I actually left in the sense of having completely free and independent trueness to my own desires? So I wonder that all the time. But I do feel very passionate about what I'm doing. I started my own firm now, and I do all the work that I had done on the defense side. I do it for plaintiffs. And so I'm able to go up against these big companies with the knowledge that I have having represented them. And if I'm doing some defense work, it's for a friend. So I do feel very, very lucky and very gratified in what I do.
I don't think we actually said specifically what your practice area is. Do you want to share a little bit about what you do, what type of law you practice?
Yeah, I do employment law. I do lemon law, so if someone's car it gets taken in more than twice for the same issue, that's considered a lemon, and California really is a big no-no. They don't let you sell bad cars here, and so the statutes are really harsh against that. I do consumer protection. I have a case against Lexus where my mom and dad had a bill from Lexus. My mom was like, oh, did you buy me a new Lexus? My father was like, no, I didn't. And someone had stolen his identity, using his identity, got them to ship a car across the country. And then Lexus kept sending him bills for 11 months. And not only that, the DMV started sending my dad bills for smog and registration delinquencies. So he's like pulling his hair out, like, what am I gonna do? And I wrote a letter to the DMV at least to get them to stop, but obviously that wasn't gonna work. And so I sued Lexus on my dad's behalf, and I'm gonna take them to trial. And I am extremely passionate about that. Yeah, this is, it's everything. Yeah, they're like trying to understand why I'm being so aggressive, and they don't realize that I was like literally born for this case, and I'm going to destroy them. And those are the kinds of things that I do.
Okay, so I have like two or three more questions I want to ask you, and then we'll wrap it up. But
sure.
I think one question is, a lot of times people don't share the more difficult parts of their journey, right? Like a lot of times, especially with social media, you're seeing, you know, look at me, I started a firm, which is amazing. But like, there's a lot that goes into starting a firm, and it's not easy. And there are a lot of questions and challenges along the way. So if you feel comfortable, is there anything about how you're currently feeling or challenges you face to get to where you are now that you would feel comfortable sharing?
Totally. The fact is that I have a very outgoing personality, and I love to schmooze with people, as demonstrated by my stories and my podcast. And I am not so great with organizational consistency, as demonstrated by the fact that I moved the time to do this podcast like five times on you. And you're very gracious. And just like, I have that difficulty, and it's probably a luxury. It's probably a privilege to be like, oh, I'm not good at organizing, like ADHD or certain things, although I could get into hot water for saying that because these could be really big debilitating things for people. But to a certain extent, I do believe that it is a luxury to say that, like, oh, I'm not good organizationally. Like, what does that mean? Gun to your head, you can organize if needed. So I'm not yet feeling the pressure of gun to my head, and I hope I don't feel that when it gets too late. But keeping track of calendar, especially in litigation as a lawyer, I've done transactional work. It's not as deadline oriented. Like, litigation is all about deadlines. And if you miss a procedural deadline, you can be in a world of hurt. You have to go to the judge and ask them to undo it, and you might not even get it. And then you could be in serious malpractice issues. So organizational things is definitely difficult. Not having enough money could be a challenge. You know, I probably don't have as much cash runway as most people would recommend before starting a firm. And so that could be a challenge. Hopefully I don't run into that, but it's definitely a stressor. And I think that exact stressor and stress in general is what prevents people from going off on their own and doing it, because why am I better than other people? I went to school with so many different talented folks, and a lot of them are not running their own businesses. And I'm in my infancy with this. So I hope that all the people that believe in me, I get to, you know, show them and do them proud.
It's interesting because there's a certain level of confidence that you have to have in order to do this, although you just expressed the doubt, but you have to have a level of confidence to be like, I think I can do this and believe in yourself. So, I mean, it's good to hear that you have that, and despite the doubts, you're pushing forward.
Yeah, I mean, I have no doubt I'm gonna be able to do this. At least I have no doubt that I wasn't able to do working for other people anymore. So I don't even know if I have a choice. I think this is my gun to my head. I have to do well. Failure is not an option.
Okay, and then one other question that I wanted to ask you in addition to that is just, you know, you've done 80 episodes right now for your podcast. You have over 30,000 listens. Like, you're really growing this, and I want to hear things that you've learned from doing your podcast interviews, especially with different lawyers or things related to the legal field. What are some insights that you've gained, whether they're practical insights that you apply to your own life or just generally things that have changed your view in any way?
I think the most important thing is listening is a skill.
Yeah.
And like how I was talking about that reading comprehension, I thought, wow, English is my first language. This is going to be a piece of cake, this test. No, reading comprehension is really difficult. And like listening, like, oh, I do that all the time. Like whenever I'm in a conversation, like absolutely not. Listening is a entire focus and skill set. And you're fantastic at it. The fact that you're able to just give me the floor and I'm yapping away, and I'm sure you have certain thoughts that you want to chime in or pull me back on or whatever. And not doing that is a really big skill set. It took a lot of interviews for me to master just that alone. And then similar to getting coffee with different people, like learning about the different areas of law that people can get themselves involved in. Like I interviewed the Solicitor General for Virginia. Like states have lawyers, and what do those lawyers do? Certain lawyers that were involved in COVID litigation, certain lawyers that went from big law and jumped in-house and hearing their different pathways, or certain people that got a JD and never practiced law and seeing how they built for themselves really respectful careers. That was something that was really eye-opening for me. So, yeah.
I love that you're doing that, because that's part of why I started Before You Take the LSAT. It was just, I felt like there should be more transparency about what a career path could look like and what career trajectories you can have post-law school. Like, there are so many different things, and it's just, I feel like if more people had insight into that, they could find something that really matches what they're good at and really actually enjoy and give back, right? And have a fulfilling career.
Absolutely. 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 I think what you're doing is incredible. You were talking about doing this 10 years ago, and you're actually doing it. You're really inspiring.
Thank you. Well, I mean, you could say the same for yourself, right? Like, you knew that you wanted to go into law, and you stuck to it, and you woke up at 5 a.m. making bagels so that you could take the LSAT course that you wanted, so that you can get a full scholarship, because your dream was to graduate debt-free. And then you went into big law, and it wasn't an easy path to get there. You made those opportunities for yourself with having the abundance mindset, right? And now you're doing your own firm. And like, I listened to your episode with Simon Law Group. His name is Bob, right?
Yeah.
So you said in the beginning of the episode, you're like, yeah, I don't know. Is this true? You said in the beginning of the episode, I just reached out to you and to Bob, right? And you were like, hey, you know, are you down to do a podcast interview? And he said, yeah, sure. When are you thinking? And you jokingly said in 30 minutes or something like that. And you guys did it. It's just like, there's just something. I'm personally very drawn to people who have that entrepreneurial mindset, or like, I guess you can call it chutzpah.
Yeah. No, it's totally respect. Chutzpah. And I just cut you off, but yeah, that's definitely
that's okay.
True. It's definitely true. And he has the chutzpah, and that guy personifies it, and it was literally like that. I DM'd him, hey, do you want to do a podcast sometime? And he goes, when? And I said, can you do it in 30 minutes? And he's like, I could swing that. And we just did it. And he has like 100,000 followers. The guy's like worth $100 million. Like, you know, he's big stuff. But I think that mentality too, of him just being open and not stuffy and like, no, you need to send me the questions before and talk to my assistant. Like, I think that is part of a level of success people can attain as well.
Yeah, it's something about recognizing opportunity and taking it, right?
Yeah.
Well, Yitzi, thank you so much for doing this interview and taking the time. I know it's not easy, especially when you're starting a business from scratch. And I appreciate you for being willing to share during this transition phase, because I feel like the transition phase is a little bit more difficult than, like, right? Obviously, like, when it's like a year or two down the line, it's a lot easier to say, like, hey, this is my experience, but I feel like it's a little harder when you're first starting. So I appreciate you being willing to do this, and I'm excited to listen to even more podcast interviews that you've done. I feel like I can learn from them too, so thank you. I appreciate you.
Thank you so much. Yeah, this was great. Like I said, there was someone that at Squire Patton Boggs, she was the legal office manager, and she had heard about your brand independently, and she was really relying on it to get herself through everything. So kudos to you for doing it, and keep up the good work. Thank you for all the work you're doing in the world.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.